válido de lunes a jueves. You
find the safari park. You're killing me, Larry.
Larry, fucking Larry.
Larry from That Larry Show.
For men with balls.
Take off your pants.
Larry, get into bed now.
Larry.
Larry. Larry.
Come on, Larry. Larry.
Kids are the greatest gift. But like many gifts, they do come with strings. You have to feed, clothe, and educate them. And put up with them when they're crazy. Like the old bumper sticker said, insanity is genetic. You inherit it from your kids. Truth be told, none of those strings bothered me. I never took them as chores or impositions. It's all good. The only annoying string that came with parenthood was again having to deal with schools, teachers, and other parents. I found that decades after my own school experience as a student, the asshole to non-asshole ratio had not changed. A few teachers were terrific, some were average, and some were assholes. That mixture holds up with the general populace, doesn't it? The exposure to my kids' teachers was limited. Open school nights, some goofy shit you'd be forcibly volunteered to do, you know, build sets for the school play, stuff like that. But the parents, there lay the rub. I've always been hyper-selective about who I hang out with. I've always believed in the old saying, better alone than in bad company. Maybe that's why I find politicians so repulsive. They pretend to like everyone. People who claim they like everybody are liars. So when you have school-age kids, you find yourself forced into all kinds of interface with the parents of your kids' friends. Many of them are gigantic assholes. People you would rather watch flail in a tank of burning oil. My parents had no idea if I was hanging out with nice kids or serial killers. They rarely met my friends, so why would they meet my friends' parents? I guess that was mostly because, even in bitter cold New York winters, we hung out where kids should hang out, on the street. Tag, touch football, stickball, we only went home for food and sleep. Oh, and to do homework, too. It was very uncommon to visit your friends at their homes. Consequently, my parents were never subjected to interaction with my friends' parents, which was probably a good thing. For my kids, it seemed there was always another kid-centric event that wound up being a social thing for parents. Once in a while, these events were held at restaurants or parks, but mainly at their homes. One time, somebody's house was literally wallpapered with every report card and homework assignment and test their kid had ever taken. It was insane. The place was a temple to little whatever the fuck Junior's name was. I'm certain I have none of my report cards. They were usually pretty well covered with A's, very few B's, and never a C, D, or F, with one exception. Back then, along with math and science and history, geography, and so on, you were graded on something that could not be empirically measured or studied, but still you were rated on it, and that always pissed me off. It wasn't a subject. It was more ephemeral. For a few years, they called it conduct. I did okay with that. Usually those were marked S or U. Satisfactory or unsatisfactory? Pretty simple. If you didn't disrupt the class or stab someone or set fire to the school, you got an S. If you behaved like an asshole, you got a U, and probably your parents were asked to meet with the teacher. Mine never were. But then, somewhere around third or fourth grade, conduct was replaced by the totally idiotic, pre-woke, non-metric metric, getting along with others. Well, that seemed like it was nobody's business. Who were these others? What if they were annoying creeps or bullies or dullards or junior commies? Why the hell should I have to get along with them? Getting along with others was where my parents first beheld red ink on my report cards with a big, fat U. Unsatisfactory. Whoa, how to explain? From the outside, people might assume that you meant I was a troubled kid, maybe a troublemaker, someone instigating fights, brawling. Far from it. When I look back now, I realize this was the dawn of social engineering. Authority figures who were displeased by organic friendships. Being ASCOs at their core, that's assholes seeking to control others, they wanted to dictate who would play with whom and select your friends for you. This goal was attempted but rarely achieved through the gambit of group projects. Teacher would dream up some task, draw a map or write a story or whatever, and then he or she would select the teams to accomplish this goal. The selections were not random. They loathed standing friendships, what they referred to as cliques. Or some of them pronounced them cliques. And so they paired kids, which they knew were incompatible, experimenting on 7- and 8-year-olds. That's where I started not getting along with others. Again, not fighting with them. I remained, I guess, some semblance of civil. But I wasn't about to let anybody pick my friends for me. Yeah, it was just a goofy school project. But I've never been real big on teams anyway, unless that team coalesced organically. Think of all the great musical acts, huh? The greatest ones. Stones, The Who, Led Zepp, The Doors, Guns N' Roses, they all formed naturally. Guys who loved the same kind of music, shared a vision, became enormously successful. The Fab Four versus the Prefab Four, huh? The Monkees. Mick and Keith, Roger and Pete, Elton and Bernie. Those are like successful marriages, which generally occur randomly. The arranged ones rarely work out as well. The commie aspect of group school projects was the system of grading. If I got good marks or shitty ones, that was on me. But these group things, where suddenly your grade is dependent upon the performance of strangers, well, fuck that. What if the team selected for you is lazy and or stupid? Now you crash and burn with them. Or do their workload. That blows. That's commie shit at its most basic level. And that was how it happened with me. I can get along with just about anyone if I want to. But in those classes, which were 3rd and 4th grade, I scored a couple of those U's. And that grade was probably not so much because I didn't get along with the team I was assigned. It was because I did not have that kumbaya, we are one attitude. I was pissed off about the entire charade and made no attempt to camouflage my chagrin. It wasn't enough for them just to subject you to this crap. You had to be glad about it or pretend to be. Years later, working for gigantic corporations, I encountered the same bullshit, usually in off-site meetings at some fancy resort. Invariably, the impetus of these things was some charlatan consultant who sold the CEO a crock of shit about team building.
Guaranteed to boost cooperation, productivity, and revenues.
They'd come up with horse shit, you know. Zip lines and firewalks and trust your team leader to catch you as you deadfall backwards off a platform. They wanted everyone to bond. By then, I was hip to this game and played along with a 100-watt smile fixed on my face. I didn't care. The checks always cleared, and they were sizable. Once the 5 o'clock whistle blew, I morphed back into extremely selective socializer Larry. At these events, I was constantly taking mental notes. I figured it might be good material for a book, or maybe plug it into a stand-up routine. One such offsite was at a dude ranch in the Arizona desert. The place was spectacular. 5-star everything, with every conceivable amenity. The only problem was I was there on company time, not my time. The first morning, there was yoga and guided meditation to be followed by team-building exercises. Everyone sat cross-legged on a small mesa with some alleged Navajo shamanette. Her name was Skyweaver, but she looked more like a Gladys. She began with spiritual cleansing, breathing exercises. Once all our negative energy and halitosis had been released into the desert air, we were told to close our eyes and open our minds. She took us on a flight on the wings of the ancient and mighty Quetzalcoatl. She stressed that it was all important that we keep our attention focused on her voice and visualize the picture she was painting with her words. Together, like a flock of pterodactyls, we were to soar in formation miles above the desert floor. We would not only see colors, we would feel the colors, absorb them, which would bind us together as a team. When she said the T word, I began my own visualizations, beginning with myself in that very same desert. But instead of surrounded by corporate drones, I'm with that crazy YouTube guy, Sarkissian, and we're shooting bowling balls out of a cannon and blowing up a safe with M67 grenades. I am blissing out. Then he unboxes a 50-cal machine gun, sets it up on a tripod. Meanwhile, the rest of the group is dismounted from Quetzalcoatl, and Skyweaver is mind-melding them into a pack of foraging javelinas. They're going to sniff out new revenue streams, like those desert pigs scrounge for pear blossom cactus. But my brain is out there blowing shit up with this crazy man and his military ordnance. Then I watch him feed a belt into the Browning Madus, and then he says in his Armenian patois, "Look, Larry, Kami's for you. Kami's for you to kill." I look through the scope sight, and sneaking out there in the sagebrush is Vlad Lenin in his long black coat and his Greek fisherman's "I'm a working man" cap. I get his pointy chin in the crosshairs, and his head just disappears in a red vapor, and that cap spins off and lands at a rakish angle on a big saguaro cactus. Next, I spot Leon Trotsky. He's trying to stay hidden, but then the sun illuminates his granny glasses. I take a breath, slowly exhale as I squeeze the trigger. No more Trotsky. Ooh, coming straight at me looking tough is Joe Stalin. Let's see if he's really made of steel. Sarkissian sets the selector on full auto, and well, look at that. Stalin is suddenly just a torso, and his legs are flat on the ground a couple yards away. I'm really enjoying this creative visualization. Then I hear a sound that is not in my head. Yep. Somebody just ripped a big one. I look around. Now I'm not the only one smiling. Later that day, we head for the stables, mount up for a 3-mile ride to a Western movie set for team building games. Only a few of us have ridden horseback. The marketing director is a total freakout and starts to scream the moment she sits in the saddle. The horse takes a single step. She shrieks so loud, the horse begins to spook. The ranch hand grabs the bridle to keep his head down. He asks her to dismount, but she's in such terror, he might as well be asking her to have his baby. It's insane. She's screaming and crying like she's being disemboweled. Everyone is drop-jawed, watching her implode. And I'm wondering if anybody's feeling team spirit. Finally, the ranch hand talks her off the horse, and she heads for her room, sobbing. After a slow and silent ride and some very old and placid nags, the western town comes into view. It's a few ramshackle facades, a saloon, a barbershop, a jail, a general store, and a green plastic portisan for your team-building comfort. It's clear the town has not been used in ages. The floorboards are loose, and there's dust and rat shit everywhere. The consultant picks the teams and then sets up some nonsensical rules for a game of capture the flag, which was actually a girl's bandana. I don't recall who won, but there was another casualty. Somebody gashed their hand on a rusty nail and demanded to be taken for a tetanus shot immediately. She was escorted on horseback to the hotel where somebody drove her to an ER. The team was dwindling, and it was only the first day. Hey, how'd I get from fifth grade in Queens to team building in the Arizona desert?
Larry, stay on task.
Thank you, my dear. Fifth grade was a quantum leap better than third or fourth, and that was because it was taught by Mr. Lynch, who was a mensch. A no-bullshit guy. He was not there to do social engineering or experiment on kids or explore anyone's psyche. He was there to teach, and he was fucking great at it. Early in the school year, he came up with the project of projects. It was a kind of a two-parter. There was going to be a competition with first, second, and third place winners and losers. That's right, losers. Just like in real life. Imagine that. There would also be teams. But he'd have no part in selecting those teams. He left that to the kids. Three guys on a team. Pick whoever you wanted. Once the team was set, there would be no trade. So, choose wisely, said Mr. Lynch. The competition would be kind of like Jeopardy. But without that stupid fucking all answers must be in question form bullshit. The questions could be anything from any part of the curriculum, math, science, history, geography, lit. And because Mr. Lynch was a very smart guy and wanted to keep everyone engaged, he might also throw in some sports or pop culture trivia. Before the competition could begin, we needed something else, a way to signal that we had an answer. So each competitor had to create some type of electrical signaling device, audio and or visual. Well, I was all over that like white on rice, and luckily, so was my old man. He loved shit like that. Over the weekend, we figured out a crude schematic. I wanted to signal with sound and sight. So the old man saw it about 16 inches off a 1x10. Then we found an old door buzzer and button. Perfect. I also wanted a light bulb, and somewhere under the workbench was a porcelain socket and a 40-watt clear tungsten bulb. All we needed was power. A quick trip to the hardware store, and we had a big 6-volt battery. We traced the setup on the board, got some wire, a drill, Phillips head screws, and we were just about to do it when the old man had a eureka moment. On the workbench in the basement was an old double knife switch. It looked fantastic. A mini version of the one in Frankenstein's laboratory. Would I like that as part of the system? Would I? Holy shit. Dad figured out the most ergonomic layout for everything so I could press that buzzer button as fast as a gunslinger, which would not only produce that annoying sound, it would also flash that harsh light bulb. Of course, it was all wired in a parallel circuit, which Mr. Lynch had suggested in science class. And I could set the whole symphony in motion, or render it dead, with that kick-ass Frankenstein switch. Anyone else would have glued or duct taped that big battery to the board, but the old man secured it with two metal straps. It looked crazy cool. When I walked into the class on Monday with that contraption under my arm, I felt like king shit. Our team assembled itself. I had some pretty good general knowledge, but was weak on math and sports. My buddy Kenny was a human sports stat machine. He knew every ball player's batting average, their RBIs, even their shoe size. And he had a math brain. He could do two-place multiplication in his head and long division. He was, surprise, surprise, no slouch with science, too. An all-round scholar. And what to call our team? I came up with a winning name. The Know-It-Alls. It seemed that those games went on for a month or two. It was incredible. Even kids who could barely fog a mirror were engaged and enthusiastic. Mr. Lynch must have stayed up late every night, dreaming up fresh questions and handwriting them on a huge stack of index cards. Kids had buzzers, bells, chimes. One kid's electric device crapped out, so the next day he signaled using a duck call. It was funny as hell. Kids who previously seemed to be loners suddenly had close pals. And nobody engineered nothing. Eventually, teams were eliminated, and those guys began to root for the remaining competitors. For the first time in my life, I did not dread going to school. I couldn't wait for morning to get there. That would not happen again until college, when the attractant was pointy co-eds that kept me mesmerized. The Know-It-Alls were kicking ass, but we wound up placing second. Even though I hated to miss first place, I really didn't give a shit because I had so much fun. As I recall this, I wonder where Kenny and Andy are. Mr. Lynch was more than a fantastic teacher. He was a wonderful human being. There's an amazing tale of the way he stood up for a beaten-down kid who really needed a friend, and Mr. Lynch proved to be that friend. You can hear that story in episode 111, Summer Reading. You'll find it in the July 2018 tab at thatlarryshow.com. Be forewarned, listening may blur your vision and put a lump in your throat. It's been a long time since I was on the Know-It-All Quiz Kid team, a team I loved and was honored to be a part of. I would go on to play with a few bands, and those are teams as well, I suppose. The best by far was the Cadillac Cowboys, which was really a two-man team, myself and my partner, Pontiac Pete. Our sidemen were all hired guns. Good guys, good musicians that could help us make a crowd stand up and stomp their feet and make old couples hold each other close. Pete is still back east, and when I finally shake the dust of California from my boots, I hope to once again take a stage or two with him. We've been keeping up our chops, still know all our old set list with some new and improved licks and riffs. Who knows? Maybe it would be at some honky-tonk that's a meetup for this very podcast. That would be a hell of a thrill. Fifth grade is a long way in my rearview mirror, but I can still see that classroom, feel that Frankenstein switch in my hand, see Mr. Lynch with his permanent 5 o'clock shadow, reading glasses on top of his head, smiling slyly when he was about to throw a curveball question in his gravelly voice. With one daughter headed for grad school and another for college, school is a hot topic at the dinner table these days. They're both still making up their minds. Wherever they choose to study, I hope there's a Mr. Lynch on the faculty. Someone who knows that real friendship can't be forced or fabricated. Thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Do you have cable TV? Netflix, Amazon, HBO, etc.? You're sending money to billionaires who hate your guts. How often do you find something really worthwhile there? If the answer is not very often, consider this. Listeners frequently email me to say that this show delivers something that cannot be found anywhere else. Not on TV or radio or among the 4 million podcasts now buzzing around the interwebs. They tell me this show is utterly unique. That's a hell of a compliment. That's what I set out to do when I began this adventure 6 years ago. To do something no one else has done. Listeners have told me there have been a few copycats along the way, but they faded away. To those majestic friends who support this show, thank you. To those who listen but don't, then lend a hand by spreading the word on your social media. Or the next time you scroll through all the mindless and woke shit on cable and toss the remote aside in frustration, slide over to thatlarryshow.com, where you will find hundreds more episodes, and click the Patreon or PayPal button and help me keep the lights on here at the Take No Shit Dojo. Follow the show on Twitter and Facebook. We have a lot of fun there between episodes. Write to me at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. I get a lot of email. I may not answer immediately, but I always do answer. My friends, we are friends because we have chosen each other. That's how it should be. The moment some institution attempts to select your friends for you, run. That's commie shit in action. I'll see you next Wednesday or thereabouts, and until that time, take no shit.